military targets and residential areas bombed. 190,000 soldiers on the move. Millions forced underground or out of the country. When Russia invaded Ukraine in February, many thought it would be over quickly, with major cities falling in days.
What they hadn't reckoned on was the determination of the Ukrainian people to fight for their freedom. Civil society was quickly mobilized to defend the country. While in Russia, it came under attack, a situation all too familiar to pro-democracy activists in Belarus.
This year's Nobel Peace Prize recognizes the significance of civil society for peace and democracy, going to human rights activists from these three neighboring countries.
The Center for Civil Liberties, an organization set up to fight corruption and promote democracy in Ukraine, which now finds itself documenting war crimes. Memorial established to ensure the victims of Soviet oppression are never forgotten. And Alice Bialyatsky jailed for daring to oppose dictatorship in Belarus.
From countries on different sides of the war in Ukraine, but united in their work for democracy and peace.
Hello and welcome to the Nobel Interview, an Al Jazeera special live from Oslo. I'm James Bayes.
And I'm Fully Batibo. Just a few hours ago, right here at Oslo City Hall, the 2022 Nobel Peace Prize was received by Jan Rachinsky from Memorial, Oleksandr Matvichuk from Ukraine Center for Civil Liberties, and Natalia Pinchuk, the wife of jailed Belarusian human rights activist Alice Bialyatsky.
Over the next hour, we'll be speaking to all three of them about the importance of civil society at a time of war and the challenges and dangers facing activists as they go about their jobs.
And we will also be speaking to two very special guests whose own lives have been impacted by the crackdowns on the fight for democracy and human rights. Now, some of our audience members here in Oslo will have the opportunity to ask questions, and you too can be part of the conversation. Connect with us using the hashtag AJNobel.
Congratulations. Thank you so much for joining us here in Oslo City Hall for this interview.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Alexandra Matvichuk from the Ukraine Center for Civil Liberties. Let me start with you. As a human rights defender, do you feel now a new sense of responsibility with this Peace Prize? And is this a vindication for the Ukrainian people?
Exactly. This Nobel Peace Prize is recognition of the efforts of the whole Ukrainian nation who bravely struggle for freedom and for our democratic choice. And this is a huge responsibility because this is a Nobel Peace Prize during the war and during the very bloody war. Before, for decades, the voice of human rights defenders from our region wasn't heard, so it's provided us as a unique opportunity.
Jan Rachinsky from Memorial, you were in court, I believe, when you found out that you had won this award, fighting to keep hold of your organization's headquarters. What does this award mean for an organization that's now banned in Russia?
Our organization is not banned. There are two organizations, the International Memorial and also the Human Rights Center Memorial, who have been disbanded and banned. But we have an association of independent organizations. We used to have hundreds of thousands of people comprised of those. Today there are tens of thousands, but there are still lots of people who are doing this work. So our activities are not banned. They have basically found an absurd formality, which was some of the publications not putting the logo for an agent. So this is the only responsibility and the only charges that they put to us.
Right, Natalia Pinchuk, you're sitting today in a seat where your husband, Alice Bialyatsky, should have been seating, receiving the Nobel Peace Prize on his behalf. Alice Bialyatsky has been in prison, of course, for the past 17 months, cut off from the outside world. I want to know first, I guess, what his reaction was when he heard the news that he'd received the Nobel Peace Prize. And what do you think this will do to his situation? Will it help him, or will it make his situation in prison worse, you think?
As for Aless, his reaction, it was quite unexpected. And I saw it from his gestures and movements, from non-verbal communication during our meeting. Unfortunately, we had only 1 hour to communicate. At the same time, whether it would help us or not, first of all, I believe we should talk not only about Aless, but about all political prisoners in Belarus. And this prize is of utmost importance because the world has heard about the Belarusian tragedy. Thousands of people are behind bars in terrible conditions. In harsh conditions, and it's very important, it's a very important message to the whole world. So this prize gives us hope.
Okay, it gives you hope. You've talked about other prisoners, of course. As you said, it's not just Aless Bialyatsky, but a number of activists who are behind bars in Belarus today, or who are in exile. I want to hear more about Aless Bialyatsky's conditions in prison, if you can share that with us. How is he being treated?
In general,
we have very little information because he is not allowed to write about his conditions in prison, and he's not allowed to discuss the situation there or the situation in the country. So I can only imagine the conditions he is held in. We communicate in writing, but he doesn't get all my letters and vice versa. So, you know, there is censorship. And he puts numbers on his letters, and it indicates how many letters we receive. So we don't receive all the letters. And the lawyers who work with him, they don't disclose any information. So it's very difficult for me to answer this question.
Okay. Natalia, thank you for now. We'll continue talking to all three of you throughout this hour. But I want to bring in someone who knows a great deal about the challenges facing the opposition in Belarus, and that is Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, who fought against President Lukashenko in that disputed 2020 election. You stood because your husband wasn't allowed to stand and he was thrown into jail at the time. You are now seen by the European Union as the leader of a free Belarus. What does this award today, what does it mean for the protest movement? What does it mean for the political prisoners, including your own husband?
So, first of all, I have to remind the world that Lukashenko is not the president of Belarus. He lost elections and trust of people back in 2020. But Nobel Prize Award is not just an award for Aless. It's a recognition of all the efforts that Belarusian people have made in order to fight for free, democratic, independence, Belarus, where human rights are respected. And actually, it's you know, Aless always said that it's not only my awards. This award's for all Belarusian people. And I hope that Nobel Prize Award will attract more attention to Belarusian humanitarian crisis, and you know, and help us to release all political prisoners, the number of which is growing every day. And it's like a remind to the world that Belarus needs you, but it also a remind for Belarusian people that they are not forgotten and they are not abandoned.
And one of those is your own husband. What's your role as the leader of the opposition? How do you think that's impacted his treatment in jail?
We have to release all political prisoners. My husband, Alesi, is one of them. And I have to say that political prisoners in Belarus are treated much, much worse than ordinary criminals. They are under constant pressure of administration of jails. They are humiliated physically and morally. They are being tortured every day. You know, they are put in punishment cells. They are deprived of normal food, fresh air, and so on and so forth. And actually, we have a lot of women in jails. It's our like pain, but I think that with assistance of the whole democratic world, with creating multiple points of pressure on the regime, we will be able to get rid of dictatorship in our country, and of course it will release all our people from prisons.
Let's turn to the war in Ukraine. President Putin had hoped to have control of at least Kiev in a week or so. The war is not going the way he would want. Do you see the fate of Putin and Lukashenko as being intertwined? And if that's the case, do you see a real possibility of change right now at this moment?
Putin is the only political and economical backup to dictator Lukashenko in Belarus. And for sure, when Ukrainians win, they will. It will weaken Putin's regime, hence it will weaken Lukashenko's regime. And the window of opportunities will be open for Belarusian people to uprise again. But it doesn't mean that we are just sitting and waiting when Ukrainians will win. We are supporting people as much as we can. 86% of Belarusians are opposing this war. They don't want Belarus to participate. We see Ukrainians as our friends, as our close nation. And, of course, our task now is to be prepared for that moment of opportunity. We are working a lot on this. We're working a lot to help Ukrainian people, but we see that we will not manage to do it alone. We really need assistance of the whole democratic world. It's our duty to release our country, but it's difficult to oppose this huge regime machine when you are forgotten or abandoned.
Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, thank you for talking to us.
James, we are going to focus now on Ukraine and take a closer look at the work of the Center for Liberties. It was established in 2007 to promote democracy and the rule of law in Ukraine. But from 2014, with Russia's annexation of Crimea and pro-Russian separatists fighting in the east, the center turned its focus to human rights abuses and potential war crimes. They never imagined the scale of violence towards civilians that would eventually unfold, as Jonah Hall reports from Makariv.
On a snowbound road west of Kyiv, where months earlier Russian tanks had rolled, war crimes investigators from Ukraine's Center for Civil Liberties are following in their tracks in an old Honda Jazz. They've come to the village of Makariv to record the testimony of a woman who says her husband was killed by the Russians.
And here is where Alexei died. From what I know, he was struck with something sharp, like the handle of a knife or a rifle stock behind his left ear. Then they brought him here and killed him. 5 stab wounds to the chest.
Her mobile phone contains a wealth of evidence. Her descriptions are stark and matter-of-fact.
Here is where his best friend Andrei was shot in the head. This is what was left after his body was retrieved. I have many photos. And Alexei's body was here. To be honest, I have no idea who put his body in the boot of the car. Here you can see the spot. We are standing where the car was parked.
It's a painstaking business collecting evidence of alleged war crimes like this, a process repeated already thousands of times, and there may well be thousands more. And they don't even know for sure whether these crimes will ever be prosecuted. There is no international tribunal yet at which to try them.
Our website is a Tribunal for Putin, and it's our database of war crimes. So you can see the number of incident, more 25,000.
Certainly, this is a process that will take time. However, we must collect this information so nothing gets lost.
Are you confident that these crimes will be brought to justice?
Yes, I'm confident justice will happen.
Justice may be slow, but the certainty is reassuring for this widow of the war and many like her.
Oleksandra Matvichuk, your organization, the Ukraine Center for Civil Liberties, wasn't set up to document war crimes in the first place. Your team has been investigating these war crimes since 2014. How disturbing has this experience been for you, especially now in the current conflict in Ukraine? What have you uncovered?
When we started our documentation in 2014, we focused on the practice of illegal abduction, torture, sexual violence and killing civilians because Russia used tactics of terror against people on the occupied territories in order to save their control. And we sent numerous reports to UN, to OIC, Council of Europe, and nothing stopped. This horror still continue, and after large-scale invasion, we faced with unprecedented level of human pain.
What sort of human pain, precisely, when you look at the conflict now in Ukraine? What have you seen and what have you witnessed in terms of the violence suffered by civilians?
We document not just violations of Hague or Geneva Conventions. We document human pain when Russian troops deliberately shelling residential buildings, schools, churches, hospitals, when they organize forcible deportations, when they commit crimes such as abductions, rapes, and torture, when they manage filtration camp systems or attack evacuation corridors.
Are you investigating crimes by both sides in the conflict? Because the international human rights organization Amnesty International was criticized earlier this year for saying that Ukrainian forces were possibly also endangering civilians by launching strikes from civilian areas. Are you looking at both sides in the conflict?
We obviously document all human rights violations, regardless of the sites, but vast majority the cases in our database is crimes committed by Russian troops. It's because Russia uses war crimes as the methods of warfare, and Russia did it in many countries of the world, like in Moldova, in Georgia, in Chechnya, in Syria, in Mali, in Libya, and others.
Alexandra, there is a team from the International Criminal Court in your country doing investigations, but my understanding is you would prefer a special international tribunal to be set up. Why do you think that's a better option? And could we see eventually key leaders in Russia, including President Putin, going on trial? Is that a real possibility?
The action of International Criminal Court is extremely important. But the problem is that International Criminal Court will limit investigation only to several select cases. And this is a question, who will provide justice for hundreds of thousands of victims who will not be selected by International Criminal Court in a situation when national legal system is overloaded with an extreme amount of crimes? So additional to International Criminal Court, we have to establish a complex justice strategy, and one of element of this justice strategy has to be international tribunal.
It seems in the last 8 weeks or so that the war has entered a new phase. Aerial bombardment, missiles from Russia, kamikaze drones from Iran, targeting the civilians, targeting the power infrastructure. Are these two war crimes? And how are Ukrainians going to survive? How's this going to affect their morale?
It's rather difficult times we expected during the winter because this is a terroristic attack to civil infrastructure, and Russians do it deliberately to deprive millions of people from water, from heat, from electricity, from light during the winter. And I myself came from the Kyiv where I have no heat in my home. And before I left Kyiv, in order to be present there, I have 3 days more without light. But I'm sure we will endure. Russia do it because they think that Ukrainians will surrender it. We will never surrender it.
All right. Jan, let me come to you. And Oleksandra talked a bit about this, the forcible sending of civilians from Ukraine into Russia. There are persistent reports that people have been forcibly moved into Russia, including large numbers of children. So civilians as targets in new ways far beyond physical violence. What have you been able to investigate about this specific issue?
I have not participated in those investigations. I'm just going to quote the colleague's words. Indeed, forceful resettlement, uncontrolled movement and transfers of people, particularly children who cannot answer for themselves. They're usually orphanage children or from different hospitals, children who are being taken to Russia without being asked. And this is really forceful deportation, transfers. It's harder to talk about the adults because this is not a direct violence, but they're given no choice. When people don't really have any choice because they're being shelled and they're being told that there is no choice whether to go to Ukraine or whether to go to Russia, they're just taken to Russia. And then many of them have to spend a lot of time and a lot of effort in order to go back home. And here I must say that for me it came as a surprise that Russian civil society could in fact self-organize. It wasn't just some existing organizations, new organizations are being set up. It is basically compassion. There are volunteer networks springing up who agree between themselves how they can help individuals, families. And in fact, there are lots of cases where people get really very serious support. Without it, it would be very difficult, particularly people, disabled people who are being helped to move back to Ukraine from Russia.
So there is support then within Russia for these Ukrainian civilians who are being forcibly sent to Russia. Is that what you're telling me?
Yes, indeed. It came as a surprise, and it is much more active than I had imagined. I had never thought that people would be so active and so proactive and so compassionate and capable to self-organize in this way.
All right. Natalia Pinchuk, President Alexander Lukashenko of Belarus finds himself today heavily dependent on the Kremlin and has been forced into a supporting role for this Russian invasion of Ukraine. But do people in Belarus support this war?
As for the situation in Ukraine, well, there are different attitudes. There is Lukashenko and his entourage, and there is Belarusian people. And of course, those positions are quite different, and it is quite different from the situation in Russia. Belarusian people don't support that aggression. Of course, Putin has a lot of influence on Lukashenko, and Lukashenko is doing everything to stay in union with Russia, but he understands that an open war with Ukraine will lead to his collapse in Belarus. As for the situation in Belarus, well, I believe Belarus and Belarusian people don't lose hope because Ukrainian victory will make Russia less strong, so Russian influence in Belarus will diminish.
Natalia, thank you. We have a large audience with us in Oslo City Hall that are listening to our conversation. Let's take a question from one of them, Peter Risbrot and Opsel. Peter, your question, please.
Dear Lobriets, my question is, what can the young people in Norway and in other European countries do to help Ukraine in the ongoing war? We hear a lot about weapons aid and emergency aid, but we are now feeling an increasing sense of hopelessness. So what can be done to contribute?
Alexandra, if you maybe can take that question. They want to help you. What do you need?
First of all, I express a huge gratitude to people in Norway and other countries of the world for the wave of solidarity which we feel. And it's very important for us in this dramatic time. I must admit that ordinary people have much more impact than they even believe. And massive mobilization of common people around the world can change the world history quicker than the UN intervention. So there are hundreds of methods how to be useful. You can call the war, you can gather the nation, you can organize rallies to urge your government to provide more assistance to Ukraine. You can make a choice to pay more for gas, but don't buy the Russian one because freedom is worth it. So you have a choice to be non-indifferent to the other people in this situation because solidarity have no limits in national borders.
Okay, thank you very much for your response there, Alexandra. Let's focus now on Russia. For many years, civil society activists in Russia have endured threats, imprisonment, disappearances and murder. Memorial was the country's largest human rights organization before it was liquidated by the government earlier this year. Al Jazeera's Mohammed Val in Moscow looks back at its work.
Stalin's rule was a time of terror for many in the Soviet Union. Millions were killed, deported or sent to forced labor camps as he sought to boost industrialization and eliminate anyone who might challenge him. For decades, the Soviet authorities covered up the true scale of his crimes until the late 1980s, when Mikhail Gorbachev's glasnost or openness policy lifted the veil on Stalinism. Memorial emerged in 1987 to document political repression in the former Soviet Union and ensure Stalin's victims are never forgotten.
Alexander Getnas, Pavel Glazov.
The idea being that confronting past crimes will help prevent new ones. It's a sentiment Vladimir Putin echoed 5 years ago while unveiling the Wall of Grief, a monument to those victims. Memorial developed into several branches, documenting abuses of power in modern Russia as well as historic crimes. They included alleged atrocities by Russian forces and their allies during the two Chechen wars, investigative work that led to the murder of Natalia Estemirova, head of the Chechnya branch. Its Ingushetia office has been firebombed and two of its activists arrested on politically motivated charges.
The crackdown on Memorial began at the same time as Russia's war with Ukraine. In 2014, months after Russia seized Crimea, the organization was designated as foreign agent. 4 months after Russia invaded Ukraine, it was liquidated. And hours after the Nobel Peace Prize was announced, a court ordered the seizure of its headquarters here in Moscow.
Jan, we've heard there the work that you do at Memorial, and particularly the work looking back at the crimes of Stalin and other leaders of the Soviet Union. Given that historical perspective, how bad are things now? And could they get even worse?
Optimists used to say that the situation may deteriorate any time, so there are no exceptions to this rule. But there is a very dangerous trend emerging because extrajudicial capacity of other authorities are expanding. So they are now can allocate an organization as an undesirable organization or a foreign agent, and it's up to an official in different agencies. It's really remindful of extrajudicial executions of Stalin's time. Hopefully we won't get there, but the trend is extremely disturbing. Nevertheless, allow me to go back and say that you cannot go back in history because too many things have been revealed and the mass media have changed dramatically. So you've just asked what the young people could do. Well, I think young people may be optimistic because the young people look for information independently. They are in contact on a peer-to-peer level and it's become a habit for them. So when young people see that in normal countries you can go on the street without being afraid that you may be arrested by the policeman just because you have a poster which doesn't meet the party line, then they have something to think about. And then they have to make a choice once they've given it a thought. I believe that current hard times won't be too long.
Yeah, and some people have compared this moment, the Ukraine war, to the Cuban Missile Crisis. in 1962, 60 years ago. That, of course, only lasted for a few days. This has already gone on for almost 9 months. Are you worried about escalation, even nuclear conflict?
Well, I think it's not just me who is concerned about it. Gorbachev released the entire world from the fear of a nuclear war, and the gap lasted for almost 30 years. However, because of Putin, the threat is becoming more tangible, and it's a serious threat. I hope that it won't get to a nuclear war, because there are sober minds who understand that there are no winners in a nuclear war. How long will the crisis protract? It depends on what the international community is about to do, because right now they are in front of a choice. Will it be inconveniences of today for many? Because you have to spend a lot in order to support the refugees, Ukraine in its fight against Russia. So it's a choice. Either it's inconveniences today or a catastrophe tomorrow. Because if Putin gets the upper hand in this conflict, it will be the end of international law, and then this conflict may emerge in other territories.
Jan, given the situation in Russia, which you've described yourself as being a very serious one, how is Memorial able to operate today with the limited resources and the limited movement that it has today? How are you able to operate? What can you do?
Officially, because we haven't been presented with any charges, we just continue doing what we've done, because other organizations have not been banned. So they continue gathering information on terror, answer questions. So many young people come to us who want to know what has happened to their great-grandfathers, great-grandmothers. And also people come to us who want to deal with today's problems. Mm-hmm. Young people need to find something to do and that they wouldn't be ashamed of doing. So, because there may be a question, what did you do during this terrible war? And then they could say, I was working with Memorial. I was involved in documenting the crimes of the past and the crimes of the present then. So the work continues.
Well, we asked a politician from the governing United Russia Party his reaction to Memorial getting this year's Nobel Peace Prize.
This is a personal matter of the Peace Prize and a memorial organization, and there is nothing special to comment on. As for the principle of the Peace Prize, frankly speaking, this is propaganda structure, part of information war. The Americans, the British, have always had very strong position in information wars. This is their forte, and they use this advantage. This is purely propaganda information campaign, nothing more.
Jan, he's playing down the importance of your award, but this is the second Nobel Peace Prize to go to an individual or organization from Russia. Some people see this as a rebuke to Putin. It must worry the Kremlin, surely.
I'm not sure to what extent it worries the Kremlin, but the man we've just heard should really try and recall the history of Nobel Prizes in Russia. It was Pasternak, Sakharov, Solzhenitsyn, who were all outcasts. But in fact, those who were purging them are not remembered anymore, and those who were being purged, the outcasts, are known to the whole world. So the present authorities, the regime, are marauding when they're using those names for their propaganda. They held the Solzhenitsyn year, the Sakharov year, and the present events, in fact, would be commented upon both of them in a very unequivocal way. So I think that the awarding this prize is a good sign for civil society in Russia. It's not just our prize. It is the prize for all Russian activists who are fighting the dark times that are descending on Russia. And I'm hoping and I'm confident that even in the future, those who are speaking against the Nobel Prize are going to be shamed.
As you would have noticed, I've now joined our audience here in Oslo, and we have another question from one of our audience members. This is David Rostad, and your question is to Jan Raczynski.
Have you seen a change in how people in Russia view your work in the last year?
Have you seen a change, Jan, in how people in Russia view Memorial in the last year and after this Nobel Peace Prize award?
Well, in fact, over the past year, and this year when the Prosecutor General asked for disbandment of the memorial, and we have realized how much support there was in our society for memorial. We knew that we had lots of supporters even before that, but it came as a surprise that so many people would come to the places where the trial was being held, to the courtrooms, and supported us. And the support is still there. And it is particularly nice to hear and to see that this is not just the support coming from Russia. And what hasn't been said and voiced today is that this prize is not just for us and not for us first and foremost. It is the whole community of human rights defenders from different countries. Human rights are above national borders. No national borders. This is a very important focus and emphasis, and I think this is why we enjoy such a broad support, because now human rights mean even more than when European Court of Human Rights was available to us as a remedy. This was the last hope for justice to be done. Now people have to think twice. And they have to think twice about what human rights are, and they have to think about those values, those common universal values.
Alexandra, in recent hours, we had some new comments that have come from President Putin. He says one way or another, all participants in the process, in the conflict, have to agree over the realities on the ground. A suggestion, perhaps, that there could be a space for negotiations. So as things stand now, should President Zelensky seek peace negotiations with Putin?
Putin don't want negotiation. Putin will stop only when he will be stopped. And what he called negotiation and some political compromise, it means the life of our people. Because when we sent mobile groups to release Bucha, Makariv, Matyzhin, Vorzel, we found dead civilians' bodies who lay scattered around the streets until liberation. We found civilian dead bodies in the garden of their own households. It's not peace. So it's occupation, and we have the name, the things, what they are. So Ukraine will never compromise with life of our people.
Natalia Pinchuk, President Putin has repeatedly said he doesn't believe Ukraine is a real country. Do you think he also considers Belarus to effectively be a Russian province?
Yes, indeed. Belarus is still an independent country only because, it profits to Putin. Belarus has representatives in international organizations, and in those organizations, Belarus always supports Russia. And that's the only reason why Belarus remains independent, just formal independence. We know that Russian troops are present in Belarus. And we also know what Belarus did during the first days of war in Ukraine.
Natalia, let's now turn now to the personal impact of the fight for democracy and human rights. Alice Bialyatsky is one of many activists who paid a high price for their work. He's devoted his life to promoting democracy in Belarus and helping political prisoners. The authorities have tried to silence him by jailing him twice. Step Varsin reports from neighbouring Lithuania, where many of his Vyazna colleagues are now living in exile.
Vilnius, a place of exile for Belarusians who have stood up against their government in Minsk. Alena Masliakova arrived last year after her friend and fellow activist Ales Bialyatsky urged her to leave home and family to avoid arrest. 5 months later, he was detained.
Of course we miss Ales a lot. I will tell you very honestly and openly, he's greatly missed as a leader and as a friend. We are trying our best to keep up the high standard Ales set for our work.
Ales Balyatsky, who was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize last month, has been promoting human rights in Belarus since the 1980s, when his country was still part of the Soviet Union. He founded Vyazna in 1996 to help political prisoners and was jailed in 2011 for 3 years.
No doubt, he is a very, very strong man who has devoted his life to the cause. Literally, every day he showed us at Vyazna and everyone else that you can achieve your goal to make Belarus more free, to make it a democratic, law-based state.
Balyatsky was among the hundreds of thousands who took to the streets in 2020, after Alexander Lukashenko, in power for 26 years, was accused of rigging his re-election as president.
It was very dangerous. Oman riot police detained people, they shot and beat people, they killed people. Ales went to the protests and became an example to others.
By awarding Ales Balyatsky as one of this year's Nobel Peace Prize recipients, the thousands of victims of the regime in Belarus have been given a face. A sign of hope for the hundreds of thousands of Belarusians living in exile, that their struggle has not been forgotten.
Alena and other Belarusian exiles hope the Nobel Peace Prize for Ales Balyatsky will encourage the international community to put more pressure on Lukashenko to step down.
We heard the story there, Natalia, of protest in Belarus and of your husband. And we also heard that many activists decided to go into exile, to flee Belarus. Why did you and your husband stay?
Well, I would like to make a short comment on the video we've just seen. The example of Vyazna, the activists that had to flee abroad, it's an example of what has been happening to this civil society in Belarus. We don't have any possibility to remain active in Belarus. In Russia, well, as I see, there is some active civil community, but in Belarus, well, it's impossible to work. People, organizations are forced to flee the country and to work abroad for the Belarusian cause. As for your question, could you repeat it, please?
Why did you decide to stay? Why did you not leave?
As for Ales, why did he decide to stay? Well, the reason was the following. Some activists from Vyazna were arrested, and he, as a leader of this organization, felt responsibility for the fate of his people. He couldn't imagine a situation where he could leave them in Belarus and flee abroad to save his life. He knew that he would be arrested and he remained in Belarus.
What do you say to others in civil society who were appalled by the repression, but at the same time in fear of being imprisoned or even worse?
In Belarus, it's quite difficult to speak up, to express one's own thoughts. It's very dangerous. People can't speak. And we saw back in 2020 that people were brutally beaten, and we remember their cries when they were brutally abused by the police forces. And all those things haven't stopped. Those beatings and abuses are still going on, but they are going on in prisons where those people can't be heard. No one can hear their cries. People can't be active in Belarus. More and more activity is being done underground. There are more and more activists who are abroad. So those who are in Belarus don't lose their hope, because they hope that the world won't forget about the war which the Belarusian state is waging against the Belarusian people. This message should be heard abroad. Belarusians need world support in order to counteract this aggression, because they are tortures. Families are suffering. You know that lots of activists have been imprisoned, put behind the bars. The best people, best representatives of our nation, our students, they were excellent students. They got international prizes, but when they decided to express their opinion, to speak against the authorities, they were thrown behind the bars. So it's a problem. It's a problem hidden inside Belarus, and we would like the world to hear about our problem.
All right, I have another audience question now, James, and from a student, as we were talking about students in Belarus now. This one is from Clara Gustava. Clara, please stand up and ask your question to Jan Raczynski.
Yes, my question is, at what point in your life were you the most afraid, and did you almost change your mind about your fight for peace and for justice?
Jan Raczynski, was there a time that you were ever scared and wanted to stop this fight that you've been leading? And if I may add, are you afraid today of going back to Moscow?
No, I'm not afraid to go back to Moscow. I've got a return ticket in my pocket. So I don't understand why I should be afraid going back to my own country. There are risks, but they're not as large as one can imagine. I think other people face greater risks. Those people sitting here in the auditorium, for instance, a daughter of our colleague, Natalia Stemirova, is here, present here in the auditorium. Natalia was murdered for her activism, and that was terrible. And I was never so afraid as to abandon my work. But yes, one can be afraid. Once when I was shelled, it was a close shave. It was a direct threat to my life, and I was afraid. But there are people who work in such conditions permanently all the time. So against their background, it would be shameful to show fear. Okay.
There are examples, real examples of behavior in such conditions, in such circumstances. And Ales Bilyatsky is one of such examples, shining examples. And we should really try and emulate them.
Well, you talked about the daughter of Natalia Estimarova. She's here with us, Lana Estimarova. Please stand up. We're going to be talking to her because she has been directly impacted by the repression. Lana Estimarova is Natalia's daughter. She was, as you said, a prominent human rights activist who was kidnapped and killed in 2009 for bringing Russian war crimes in Chechnya to light. She helped Memorial document abuse in Chechnya. Lana, first of all, what does this award mean to you, and what would it have meant to your mother, Natalia?
First of all, I have a very strong feeling that I can't shake off that although I'm very honored to be in the presence of such distinguished guests, I shouldn't really be here. It's my mother who should be here. She should be receiving the award. She should be giving this interview. But alas, this is the reality that we're in. That's why the news of this award was a very pleasant surprise, and it stirred a lot of emotions in me. And I thought for a while about what it means to me and what it would have meant for my mom. For my mother, it would have meant the world, because working in such gruesome conditions in Chechnya while trying to raise a daughter, being a single mother, living in a house with no electricity and running water, Alexandra will relate to this. It's full of challenges, but she just believed in the sense of mission, and nothing could stop her. No threat could ever stop her. but every time she would get an international award, every time she would be recognized for what she did, she always used it as an opportunity to talk about what's happening in Chechnya, to remind the world about all the atrocities committed by the Russian army. That's why I'm very proud that I'm in a position to carry on her legacy in my own way.
But Lana, 13 years after your mother's murder, Ramzan Kadyrov is still in power. Vladimir Putin is still in power. Memorial, where she worked, can only operate in a limited manner. How does that make you feel?
Sometimes it makes me feel angry, but I never feel hopeless because my mother's colleagues and these incredible people sitting on the stage right now, they're carrying on her work in a sense, because this fight for human rights and for our common dignity, it's not just an academic concept. It's a reality that we're all fighting for.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Lana. James, over to you.
Let's get some final thoughts. Alexandra, the three countries here have a historic bond. How do you bring the people of those countries together at the end of the war?
This Nobel Peace Prize was given to human rights defenders, not to the countries. And this is a very important human story because civil society and human rights defenders always build invisible ties and protect people in circumstances when the law doesn't work. And now we continue jointly to resist to common evil which tries to dominate in our part of the world. And I couldn't predict what will be in future, but I know for sure that we have to do our best in order to create future which we want.
So, Jan, what would the region look like if there was no Vladimir Putin in power? How different would things be?
Well, it's very difficult to imagine the world without Putin. He has been in power for so long. Let's hope that we'll see the day, and that world is going to be based on respect for international law and not on efforts of separate countries to destroy that international law.
Natalia, finally you, after everything we've heard, are you just a little hopeful there could be change?
Of course, I hope that Belarusian voice will be heard by the international community. I hope for this, people in Belarus hope for this, and those compatriots who live abroad also hope for this.
Thank you, Natalia. Thank you so much for all of you for this fascinating discussion. Congratulations on winning the Nobel Peace Prize, and thanks, all three of you, for your bravery.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you to our audience here at Oslo City Hall and to all of you watching us from around the world. This has been an Al Jazeera special from me, Fully Batibo, and the whole team in Oslo. Thank you for watching.
Thank you so much.